Doctor Petrona.
Yes, sir. The same thing for everyone.
Okay, just sharing is gonna try.
Sure.
Good evening, sir. How are you? I'll come, sir. You're on mute. The system is set to mute. Can you unmute, please?
Good evening, everyone. I did not get the memo. I would have put the same background, right? So no worries. This will make not an issue.
We can shoot it across to you right now, sir, on WhatsApp.
Happy to do that. It does take a couple of seconds.
Please give me.
Sure, sir. We'll do that.
Oh, got it. Thanks. I think technology revolution is already in play, right? Within saying enough, within a couple of seconds, I already got it. That's great.
I think Dr. Pitroda is just joining him. We sent him the link.
Sure.
Hello, everyone.
Good evening, Dr. Pitroda. How are you?
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Thank you.
Yeah. Shall we start, Dr. Pitroda?
It's up to you.
All right. Thank you.
A very good evening, one and all, and a very good morning to you, Dr. Pitroda. It is my pleasure to welcome you all to this leadership talk with Dr. Sam Pitroda. I'm sure most of my friends here have admired reading about Dr. Pitroda and their engineering days. And it is an absolute delight and honor that we have him today live with all of us. Thank you, sir, for accepting our invitation for this event. I would now like to welcome our honorable chairperson, Professor Arkam Mateen, who has been very instrumental in shaping both PGPBL as a course and all of us as future business leaders. Kudos to the professor who has made learning operations management a cakewalk. Thank you, professor, for joining us today. And may I kindly request you to welcome our chief guest, Dr. Sam Pitroda. Over to you, sir.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. And special thank you to Dr. Pitroda for kindly accepting our request. And it's one of those moments for me, right? I mean, we have the audience which is slightly younger, but for those of me of my, you know, age dispensation, when I was young, general knowledge was one of those subjects that, you know, loved a lot. And believe you me when I tell you that one of the interesting questions which used to be asked was, who is the father of India's IT revolution? And I would always look for that option and, you know, mark the appropriate option. Thankfully, I always got the answer correct. So it's a real, you know, honor to be here with you, Dr. Pitroda, and thank you so much for, you know, very kindly accepting our request. I think everybody knows Dr. Pitroda, so my words won't do justice to him, but nevertheless, now that I have been requested, so allow me to do that. So Dr. Pitroda has been at the forefront of India's IT and technological revolution for the last several decades. He's one of those who have been instrumental in shaping the rise of India as a superpower, tech superpower. And if you look at the journey which he has made, right, it's truly astonishing, right, the kind of transformation that we have built to have. So starting from a Gujarati family in Odisha, moving all the way up to advising several prime ministers in different roles. That is truly, truly amazing. And right now, he's the founding chairperson of 5 nonprofit organizations, which have their focus areas across dimensions, whether it's about knowledge, whether it's about health, whether it's about food. So he's actively involved in trying to contribute to all those debates, shaping policy, helping better our understanding. So his recent book, I'm sure many of you would have read by now, it's Redesign the World. And one of the interesting things about the book is he tries to look beyond binaries and tries to look at the problem in a very, very holistic manner. And looking at how do we redesign a world which has been shaped by so many new trends, whether it's COVID, whether it's hyperconnectivity. So the book tries to engage with all of these topics. And interestingly, the book also documents the kind of professional and personal sacrifices that Dr. Pitroda had to make in order to truly help all of us come to this place. So we are really, really thankful for him to be taking the time out. And sometimes when I sit back and reflect, right, I remember, when having a wide network of PCOs was a big achievement, to coming to Zoom, all of us sitting there in the middle of a pandemic. I think the world has definitely come a very, 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 very long way. And a number of giants have helped move the world along. And it's my real pleasure to have one of those gentle giants to be amongst us, Dr. Pitroda. And I think I'm sure it will be an enlightening session, a bit of a fanboy moment also for some of us, most definitely. So thanks a lot. Thanks from the bottom of my heart, Dr. Pitroda, for accepting our request and gracing the Institute and the BL program with your presence. We have just started the BL program. We have the second cohort. They are trying to engage with different industry leaders, trying to get a sense of how the world works at the policy as well as implementation levels. So I can't think of anyone better to help them guide better their understanding in this regard. So thank you so much once more. And we look forward to a really, really insightful session. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you so much for the welcome speech, Professor. On behalf of the whole IMK community, I would once again like to welcome our chief guest. Let's join our hands to welcome the father of India's computer and IT revolution, Dr. Sam Pitroda. I don't know if few words would do justice to define a genius who has spent more than 50 years in molding and revolutionizing the information and communication technology sector, both nationally and internationally. An inventor, an entrepreneur, a development thinker, and a policymaker, Dr. Pitroda has done it all. Credited with having laid the foundation for India's telecommunications and technology revolution of the 1980s, Dr. Pitroda has been a leading campaigner to help bridge the global digital divide. As an advisor to Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi, Dr. Pitroda led 6 technology missions related to telecommunications, water, literacy, immunization, dairy production, and oil seeds. He was also the founder and first chairman of India's Telecom Commission and always focused on access to technology as the way to social change. But his aspirations never stopped in taking this technology revolution a notch higher every time. In the second phase of India's technology revolution in 2005, Dr. Pitroda headed India's National Knowledge Commission to provide a blueprint of reform for the knowledge-related institutions and infrastructure for the 21st century India. Recently, Dr. Pitroda, with the rank of a cabinet minister, served as an advisor to the Prime Minister of India on public information infrastructure and innovation. He served as the chairman of the Smart Grid Task Force, as well as the committees to reform public broadcasting, modernize railways, deliver e-governance, and other developmental activities. In addition, Dr. Pitroda is a serial entrepreneur, having started several companies in the United States. He holds around 20 honorary PhDs, close to 100 worldwide patents, and has published 5 books and numerous papers and lectured widely all over the world. Sir, it is truly inspirational to see your contribution to the telecom sector, and your entrepreneurial spirit is very motivating. I'm sure everyone is excited to listen from you. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome Dr. Sam Pitroda. So the stage is all yours.
Thank you, Ayushi. Dear Professor, my friend Siddharth, dear students, teachers, ladies and gentlemen, greetings from Chicago. It is indeed a special honor and privilege for me to be with so many bright management students. I'm delighted to have this opportunity, and I want to thank organizers for this opportunity. Just before we started, I called Siddharth and I said, what do you want me to talk about? You know, because I go from meetings to meetings to meetings, and sometimes it is like being a robot. You don't know what is the topic. You don't know what is the audience. And every once in a while, you goof it up. And you wind up saying wrong things to the wrong, to the right people. So he clarified and he said, look, it is about your book. And maybe you want to talk a little bit about your journey. So thank you for putting me on track. You know, sometimes I do 7 or 8 of these a day. It is humanly not possible for me to be right, to be wise, and to be saying sensible things all the time. So bear with me. I want to first tell you a little bit about my own journey. And the reason for that is to let all of you, especially students, know that if I can do it, you can do it much better. The tools I had were very different from the tools you have. I was born and raised in a small little tribal village in Orissa. No electricity, no water, no phone, no radio, no television, no pharmacy, no doctor, almost no schools. My father had 4th grade education. He came from Gujarat to find work in Orissa, of all the places, in 1930s. We were 8 in the family, 5 sisters and 3 brothers. And we lived in an environment where right across our street was a Muslim family. Next to it was Jain, Marwari. Next to it was Sardarji, and the back was Oriya tribal family. We all sort of grew up together, lived together in peace and harmony, respected each other, and we all went off in different directions. Since there are no good schools in the village, my parents decided to send my older brother and I, when I was about 10 years old, to a boarding school in Gujarat, where I got my grounding in Gandhian values. At home, Gandhi was our role model. Being Gujarati, my parents had special emotional connection with Gandhi. So in school, some fundamental values were emphasized by our Gandhian teachers. And that became a platform to operate in life, including in science, business, family, community, everywhere that Gandhian platform became the foundation on which to build on. In early days in school, in the 5th grade and 6th grade, our Gandhian teachers emphasized truth and absolute truth, trust in fellow student, love freedom, justice, inclusion, because in the boarding there were all kinds of people from all caste, all color, they look all different. These simple things, along with collaboration, cooperation, that became or did become a way of life. Remain in the boarding school where there was discipline, get up at 5 in the morning, exercise, eat a little bit of your breakfast, do this, prayers, all that was part of a discipline. Make your own bed, wash your own dishes, wash your own clothes. For a 10-year-old boy, that was quite challenging. Our parents were about 1,000 miles away from where we were, so you couldn't go home except during Diwali holiday and summer holidays. There was no communication except a postcard. So it was quite an interesting experience which empowered us to take responsibility at very early stage in life. We realized that we are responsible for what we do. Our parents have put too much trust in us and we can't let them down. So we worked hard. So discipline, respect for other human beings, morals, ethics, all became very much part of way of life. After 5 years, we moved on to Baroda, which was a bigger city. Then went to college there. I had interest in physics, so got a BSc in physics, master's in physics. In the process, one fine day, I read in the newspaper that President Kennedy has decided to send man onto the moon. And that sounded romantic, exciting. And I said, this is the thing to do. Let's go to America. I had no money. We were poor. So I borrowed some money and took a boat from Mumbai to Karachi, to Aden, to Egypt. Went through Suez Canal, took a bus to see Cairo and pyramids, connected at the other end of the canal. From there, went to Naples to see Pompeii, then to Genoa in Italy, where our boat journey ended. From there, took a train to London. From London, took a plane to New York, and from New York, took a bus to Chicago. This was about 57 years ago. And coming to America was unthinkable. I had no idea what Chicago meant because there was no internet to learn and there was difficult to get catalogs and information in those days, because to learn anything, you had to go to US Information Service. You know, I wanted to know about courses to be taken. I had to take a train to go to Mumbai, wait in line, get a catalog for 5 minutes, jot it down, and then take a train back. Those were the days. I had never used telephone in my life before coming to America. I was too poor to have a telephone. And somebody who had a telephone, he was too rich to be my friend. So there was no need to call anybody. I had never seen a television, but I knew how to design one because I had a master's in electronics. So everything in America was an adventure. Learning about everything new became a challenge. I came here to get a PhD in physics and then found out it takes 7 years to get a PhD in those days. I had a girlfriend in India and I said, I'm not going to spend 5 to 7 years. I want to get married. So my professor said, go get a degree in electrical engineering. You might take less than a year. I said, that's what I want to do. So I changed my subject, got a master's in electrical engineering, got a job, earned enough money to buy a ticket for my girlfriend. She came here and we got married here. 1966 and started my life. By accident, I got to work on digital communication in 1965. Sheer accident, no planning, no strategy, no thinking, nothing. It just, life is full of accidents for me. And got a lot of patents. Worked there for about 8 years and then finally decided to set up my own business in 1974 to manufacture digital switching systems along with two Americans. I owned a small little piece of the company, built that and sold it to Rockwell International in 1979, made a little bit of money, became head of Rockwell for Cedar Rapids, Chicago, and Dallas, a corporate jet, 2,000 people working for me. And it was a pretty successful life in those days for a guy from a tribal village in Orissa. That was pretty satisfying. So I decided to come to India to take my parents to see Taj Mahal. I also wanted to show off to my parents that their son has done okay, and they should be proud of him. And then when they came to Delhi, I decided to call my wife so they could talk to her and could make a phone call. Tried again and again and could not make a phone call to Chicago. This was 79, early 80. Little bit of arrogance and a lot of ignorance said, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to fix India's telephones. I realized that if I had known everything I know today about India, Indian bureaucracy, I would have never tried it. So the lesson I learned is that the ignorance is a great asset. Don't underestimate the power of ignorance. Because then you can take risk. If you know too much at times, you back off, you analyze, you procrastinate, you find multiple strategies and you don't know which strategy to take and you don't plunge in. In life, at times you have to plunge in. You cannot make decisions based on all the facts because all the facts are never available. Whatever is available today is the reality and move on. If you wait for all the right data to come in, you'll never make a decision. Once you make a decision, you got to stick to it, proceed with positive attitude and find solutions. And can't go back and say, oh, I wish I had done it this way. I shouldn't have done it that way. I always look forward and not backward. I derive strength from history, but I don't talk about history. I never relate to Ram and this and that, and I have no interest in it. Okay. I want to look forward. Okay. Don't give me all this nonsense about what happened in, you know, Indian our heritage and all that. Fine. Believe it, but I don't want to hear about it. I have eyes in front and not in the back. I want to look forward. So then by accident, I got to meet Mrs. Indira Gandhi, gave her a presentation in 1980, and the message was, IT and telecom will change the face of India. She agreed and let me set up Center for Development of Telematics, part of a Government of India enterprise. Then when she died, Rajiv Gandhi became Prime Minister. We were just about the same age. So we clicked. And I decided to come back to India, lock, stock, and barrel with my family, change my nationality back to India, and work with him on telecom, IT, technology missions, literacy, immunization, water, cooking oil, milk production, and telecom. Those were the early days of computers and IT So people used to ridicule us, saying, what do these people know about India? They should be worrying about agriculture and food and not about computers and toys. We wanted to computerize railway reservation. And we had huge resistance from unions and everybody saying this will destroy job market in India. Remember, this was 1980-85. Many of you were not even born then. Most of my work in India was done by 89. Those were the romantic days of my life, where we worked very hard. We had a dream of taking India into 21st century with dignity, respect, global recognition, and new tools and technology. So we use technology to bring about generational change. We eradicated polio because we planted seed for vaccine production. Then we had 2 million telephones. Now India has 1.2 billion telephones. Then we had zero software export. India today has $150 to $200 billion worth of export in software services every year, year after year. India has been completely transformed in many ways. But people have very short memories. They don't remember these things. Still, people say, oh, nothing got done in 70 years. They are naive, they are ignorant, they are liars. A lot got done. And it got done because of young people like you who helped us in implementing CDOT, telecom reforms, IT revolution, building supercomputers. All of that was possible because of Indian talent. Indigenous development, local production, Indian model of development, and political will from then Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. In a sense, Rajiv Gandhi gave meaning to my own life. I was just an engineer. And he gave me a direction that you can help build a nation. Unfortunately, Rajiv Gandhi got killed. I ran out of money because I never took salary in India. And I had two kids ready to go to college. So I had to come back to US after his death. But I had given up my nationality, US nationality. So I had to come back as a tourist. I came as a tourist, but you could work as a tourist. So I had to start a business, build a business. But that didn't interest me anymore. You were almost running a country, and to run a small business was not interesting. Because I had made a decision when I decided to come back to India that I want to devote my life not to build a business, but to build a nation. And building a nation is very different from building a business. But I needed to build a business to survive. I had to pay for tuition for my children. I had to put food on table. And all the money I had made in selling the company looked like a lot of money at one time, but after 10 years, it wasn't enough. So I had to restart my life again in America. Did that, and when Manmohan Singh became prime minister, decided to come back again, knowing that telecom and IT is on autopilot. Next big challenge is knowledge. So went to Manmohan Singh, explained to him what I wanted to do. He immediately agreed and set up a commission on knowledge. Then focused on innovation and digital India. When BJP government came to power, I again came back to the US to live a private life. So my highs have been very high in life and my lows have been very low. In the process, I had two quadruple bypasses, I had cancer, and life has been challenging in many ways. But sticking to the Gandhian values has helped me a great deal in recovering from many of these issues. I'm 80 years old today, but I feel like a 30-year-old. Because I continue to work, learn, interact with young people like you. And there are many lessons that I have learned. So during Corona crisis, I was locked up in the house for 18 months. I did not leave my house for 18 months. Didn't go out, didn't drive anything. Somebody delivered all the groceries and my wife and I stayed here. We have two kids. I have a boy who went to MIT, got an MBA from Harvard. He's in Silicon Valley, married to an endocrinologist, doctor, and he lives in California with two kids. We have a daughter who went to Michigan, then went to London Business School, got an MBA, and makes movies in Hollywood. And she lives in California as well. So my wife and I decided to stay home. And during that time, I started thinking about my own journey again and realized that the world was last designed at the time I was born. That design gave birth to UN, World Bank, NATO, WTO, WHO, GDP, GNP, per capita income, balance of payment. And that design is being followed by everybody in the world without understanding that we are all operating based on that design. We just take it for granted that this is the world is. This is the way it ought to be. Everybody should work on improving GDP, GNP, per capita income. Everybody should worry about balance of payment. Everybody should follow this, follow that. And I realized that lots of things have happened in the last 80 years, and we have not created one new global institution in the last 80 years. How can something survive for 80 years? So in the last 80 years, the world got decolonized. China could rise like no one had ever thought of. Soviet Union fell apart. Technology became pervasive. Technology created inequality. 9/11 was a response to a unipolar world. And finally, COVID-19 put the entire world to halt. And COVID-19 said that we are all interconnected, interwoven, interrelated, irrespective of what we look like, what religion we follow, what language we speak, what country we live in. Urban, rural, educated, uneducated, young, old, black, white, everyone is affected by COVID. So message from COVID to me was that there are only two important things, planet and people. Planet is in pain because of environmental blunders. People are in pain because of inequality, because basic needs have not been met. When I superimpose on this hyperconnectivity, I see whole new possibilities. For the first time in the human history, we are all connected. Never happened before. The key question is, how do we use this connectivity to take human civilization to the next level? Do we use this connectivity to improve productivity and efficiency of things we do today? Or we use this connectivity to do things that we have never done in the past? Connectivity to me is all about democratization of information, knowledge, decentralization of implementation, and demonetization of services. Connectivity to me is also all about content, curation, context. So in a hyperconnected world, we need a new design. And that design cannot focus on existing sort of global conversation on geopolitical equations, markets, economy, employment, trade, balance of payment, foreign exchange. That is the conversation today. So I felt that the conversation ought to be to take the five basic principles that we had during first design, vis-a-vis democracy, human rights, capitalism, consumption, and military. These five pillars of the design in 1942 has gotten us where we are. It has created rule of law that everyone follows. It has improved longevity, decreased infant mortality, lifted millions out of poverty, and done a lot of good things. Maintained peace, but at the same time, poverty, hunger, violence, environmental blunders are major global challenges that we have not been able to solve. So the design I propose is to take democracy to inclusion, because all over the world, most of the societies are not inclusive. In India, how we treat our Harijans, minorities, in America, Black Lives Matter. Until we build inclusive societies, the tensions in the world will continue. What is happening in Afghanistan is all about exclusion. All our wars have to do with exclusion. Arab-Israel conflict is exclusion. Vietnam was exclusion. I worry about what is going on in India today in many ways, because we are dividing societies in the name of religion. Until we focus on inclusion, societies will continue to be in stress. Second, today we can produce anything. We live in an economy of surplus. So we must move away from just human rights to human needs. Three, we need new economy. Capitalism hasn't done well for a large number of people. It has created huge inequality with concentration of wealth in the hands of very few. So we need new economy, which is bottom up, which is focused on small and medium scale industries to network, to scale. And we need to go beyond GDP and GNP to also look at gross environmental product, gross human development product. We need to change our mindset from consumption to conservation and sustainability. And hopefully, ultimately, we need to build a non-violent world. Today, we spend $2 trillion a year on defense. And all we need is $200 billion to eliminate hunger world over. At one-tenth of the cost, we can make this world much better. Look at the cost of fight in Afghanistan. Over $1 trillion has been spent for 35 million people. 20 years, and we have not been able to solve the problem because we did not focus on human development. Unless and until we realize that there are only two things in life that matter, planet and people. Planet doesn't need us, we need planet. And people need to be treated with dignity, respect, irrespective of what they believe in, what they look like, where they come from. So I think hyperconnectivity is a new tool to redesign the world. That's the book I wrote. We can have a conversation. Not that I have all the answers, not that this is going to solve world's problem, but it is going to begin a new conversation. And that new conversation can only begin with students like you. So I want to thank you again for giving me this opportunity. We can open up for a broader conversation. My apology for taking a little longer than I had thought. I thought I'll take 30 minutes. I've taken 37. So my apology. Okay, let's now open up for a conversation. Professor, I turn it over to you, or to Ayushi.
Thank you, sir, for sharing your journey with all of us. And your vision about redesign the world is really inspiring. And I believe that the human development part of it that you talked about, it actually calls for young leaders like us to rethink our vision for this country and eventually the world. So as you've already given us permission for a few questions, we have a lot of questions from the cohort. And we'll start with Dheer, who has a question for you. So Dheer, you may ask your question, please.
I can't hear you.
Yeah.
Sir, thank you, first of all, to do this, to agree to do this. Like Arkham sir told in the beginning, everybody here is fanboying right from the word go. So my question to you is, actually, I partly agree with you when you say that the world needs to have a third vision. First vision is the American vision, which we are following since the 1940s after the World War II. The second vision is the Chinese vision, which China wants us to follow. And you are saying that the third vision is people and planet, not an India vision, not anything else. What is the ideal roadmap for this, according to you? When can we achieve it? Maybe 10 years, 20 years. And what can we as maybe future leaders, business leaders or just leaders can help in this journey of the third vision, which is planet plus people?
First of all, I have no idea of when it will get done. I am probably not even qualified. But that doesn't stop me from planting seeds. I'm planting a seed. It is up to you, your generation, to make sure that the seeds become tree and tree give you fruits. For that to happen, you must believe in something. And if you don't believe in it, this can never happen. So when I talk to young people in India, I worry a lot. Because I think their value systems are screwed up. Partly from parents, partly from political bosses, partly from religious roots. And they have forgotten that they are citizens of the world. They cannot be parochial that I'm from Kerala. I'm a boy. I'm a girl. I'm a carpenter's son. I'm Brahmin. I'm Muslim. I'm Christian. You got to rise above all that. And you have to say, I'm a human being and I'm a global citizen. Whatever I do will have impact on the world. For that, you have to believe in truth. Trust, love. You got to love everybody, including your animal and your enemy. You can't be jealous, vindictive. And when I see what is going on in India today about lies, cheat, I worry about India. So you have to say, I stand for democracy. I stand for freedom. I stand for justice. I stand for truth. I will not tolerate lies. If you don't believe in these things, we have nothing to talk, you know? I mean, somebody says, look, you know, we have a discussion. I said, I cannot have discussion with you, my friend, because you lie. So fine, I respect you, but I cannot have conversation with you. Because what you say is very different from what you mean. And what you mean is not something you say. So how can I have a conversation? So young people first will have to decide on the value, saying, what do I stand for? And then promote that idea in your family, in your neighborhood, in your community, in your work. Then you will become a change agent. You are the change agent that will bring about change, not me. I'm done. I'm 80. You know, I don't have the kind of energy you have. I wish today I was your age. But we all have a journey, and my journey is going to end pretty soon, which is perfectly normal. I have no regret. Not that I did everything right. I have no interest, you know, in sort of evaluating. Whatever happened, happened. I had a great time. I had a wonderful family. I have a girlfriend I've been, you know, married to for so many years, and I have wonderful children, great friends, no complaints. But I want young people. And you all look very smart. I mean, look, I mean, I can see the faces and I see the energy. But I worry that you get sucked into all this Indian political drama, useless debate, petty differences. You look at television debates in India. I feel sorry for them. I said, who are these people? What are they arguing? And people get excited. Students in India can bring about generational change, but they're not doing it. They're sitting in the back. And then you have this union, BJP union, Congress union, this union. I mean, come on. You don't need all that crap. You need fundamental values. When somebody lies, you need to be able to, I wouldn't say fight with them, but bring to their notice. Look at what goes on in social media. I mean, how are we using social media? Our young people are using social media for something I don't agree with. Our job is to promote education, health, wellness, understanding, knowledge. There are three fundamental challenges in India today, according to me. One, institution building. All our institutions have been captured. Poor vice chancellor has very little freedom because somebody sitting in Delhi decides what he should be doing. Vice chancellor should be given complete autonomy to run the university. Don't have it. I know it. Our judiciary is not independent. Our income tax office is politicized. So every one of our institutions have been captured. Two, our civil society is not at the table to make all the decisions and policies. It's only between business and government. Civil society is very active in India, and we need to really strengthen that and give them space. And third, we have lost scientific mindset. When we promote cow urine as the recipe for good health, you got a problem. Okay. And people believe it. And people love it. I don't get it. Based on what data? Okay. So I think this is where the young people have to speak up, saying, hey, we need scientific thinking. You're trained to think logically, rationally, objectively, systematically. You can argue without getting mad. You can debate, discuss. And that's not what goes on in the country. And you let it happen. So, sorry about this big lecture.
No, thank you, sir.
Thanks for such an honest answer, sir. The next question is from Shruti. Shruti, you may ask your question, please.
Good evening, sir. It's definitely a big moment for me because back when in engineering, when we were studying about you and reminding our friends that have you read Dr. Sam Pitroda's chapter properly, because it's the most important chapter for the examinations. In my wildest dreams, I have never thought that I would be honored to be in a session with you and would be directly interacting with you like this. Thank you so much for the session, sir. So I have one question. So what was the biggest challenge that you faced when you were working on the policies to connect India with respect to telecommunications?
Thank you, Shruti. Thank you for your comments. I'm just an ordinary man. You know, I just get up in the morning, do my work, sweep my floor, cook my meal, you know, help my wife. I'm a pretty ordinary guy. So don't let this image, you know, be the guiding force. My biggest problem was mindset of the people. Everybody said it can't be done. They say, you're crazy. You want to change India's telecom? Are you crazy? Some people will say, oh, work on agriculture and water. Why are you working on telecom? Telecom is for the urban elite. And my answer to them was, I don't know anything about agriculture. I know something about telephone. Let me fix that. You find somebody else for water. Okay. You can't expect me to solve all the problems. I can solve only one little thing, which I know. And that also I can try. So the biggest problem was mindset. Everybody advising you when you do something. If you're trying to go north, they'll say, don't go north, go south. And if you go south, say, no, that's not a right place, go east. Basically, what they told me, don't do anything. Okay. And no one believed that things can be done, except the young people. Young people gave me all their best part of their life. Average age was 23. They believed in me and the idea we had. They backed me up. Without their support, I would not have been able to do what I did. So I believe in young talent only when they are sort of shielded properly, only when they are trained properly, only when they have proper leadership, okay? Because they also need support. As soon as they go to work, they get corrupt because they know boss is corrupt. Growing up in India, you know your dad doesn't pay tax. Your uncle cheats. Your teacher doesn't teach. Your doctor gives you wrong injections. You know all that stuff, no? Your politician doesn't mean what he says, okay? So you think that's the only way to succeed. And you get sucked into that system. And how do you fight that system? You know. So my basic problem was people didn't believe it can be done. But my advantage was, one, I had political will from then Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. So I could do anything. He said, look, Sam cannot do anything wrong. He backed me up 100%. If I went and said something to press, no problem. If I had this, that, no problem at all. Then, whatever I said, my young team delivered. So I had young people to back me up at the bottom. I had someone to back me up at the top. And I had domain expertise to be able to do what I wanted to do. I was clear. I had no personal agenda. I did not want to make money. I took no salary. I took no benefits, no health insurance from government, nothing. I said, then only I can do what I want to do. So there were a lot of roadblocks, but you can still do it. You have to dream. And my job was much easier. Look at the job of all our freedom fighters. Their job was much more difficult. You know? And we have to do what we have to do.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir, for taking the question. The next question is from Shama.
Thank you, Ayushi. And good morning, sir. It's an absolute honor to be talking to you right now. I think some time ago when we got to know we'll be speaking to you, the first call I dialed was my father telling him that, okay, hear this. We're going to be talking to Dr. Sam Pitroda. And I think that made this MBA worth it in that one moment for having this amazing opportunity. So, sir, like while talking to him, I did not prepare a question. And I think I resonate Shruti's emotions right now. And we had a exactly similar question that what kind of implementing a telecom infrastructure in a country like India where there was no resources and means, how did you do it? What kind of obstacles did you face and how did you overcome it? And I think you just answered it. So maybe this is just me talking to you, but yeah, if you want to add into anything. And my actual wonder was, how did you do it politically? Like, how do you move papers? How do you make sure that it goes through? And you did it in few years. This kind of thing takes years. And yeah, you did it in like literally in one decade. So
that's it. Thank you. You're very generous. But I would recommend, if you have time and energy, to read a book called Dreaming Big. Have you seen it?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Go to Google. It was published. It's called Dreaming Big. I wrote that. That's my biography, autobiography. I'll tell you why I wrote it, because I have a granddaughter who is now 10 years old, Arya. And when Arya was born, I held her in my hand. And I said, you know, this girl could have been born in a tribal village in Orissa. She just happens to be lucky to be born in San Francisco. But someday, when she grows up, she's going to ask, who was this old man who came to America 100 years ago, 75 years ago? And whatever her parents tell her is going to be very different because her parents were born in America. They have no idea of India. They've been to India as a tourist. They don't know what happened in Orissa, how poor we were, how 8 of us lived in a small little home. And I said, I want my granddaughter to hear that story from me. And before I get too old or before I get paralyzed, before I have another heart attack, I better write it for her. So I took a year and wrote that book, Dreaming Big. When I talk about my feelings, just to give you an example, you know, when I took a boat, my family had come to send me off in Mumbai, including my girlfriend. And as boat moved, I could see the gateway of India slowly and slowly becoming smaller and smaller. Then I see this land called India. And all of a sudden, everything disappeared. And I tell you, I had the shock of my life. I said, oh my God, I left everything. It's all gone because you couldn't call on those days. There were no telephones. So I said, look, why did I do this? My girlfriend, my sisters, my parents, my life, my food, my culture, my mother, everything is over. And I'm 22 years old. And I had tears in my eyes. How do I explain to my grandchildren that moment? Because her father and mother won't even understand what that moment was. That idea of connectivity was very special to me. That wouldn't it be nice to be able to connect with them? Today, you know, you assume everybody's on Zoom. In fact, my granddaughter asked me a few months ago, saying, Dada, when did you get your first cell phone? Because she's 10 and she's looking for a cell phone. So I said, when I was 55, she said, oh my God, what? She had no idea that there was no cell phone before. Then she said, when did you get cell phone to my dad? Okay. I said, when he was, you know, 25. Because she has no idea that there was a world before cell phone. There was a world before Zoom. My grandson, who is 5-year-old, talks to me 3 times a day on Zoom. He has to speak to me before going to school, give me a report. As soon as he comes back from school, he has to talk to me. And then before going to sleep, he has to talk to me. It's a different world. So read that book, Dreaming Big. It'll be an interesting human story, but also a story of India. It is not just my story. It is a story of India where we lived without electricity, without running water, without cell phone, without, you know, anything. And we were happy. It's hard to imagine today. Okay. So I would request you to read it. It'll be interesting for you. Okay?
For sure. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Dr. Pitroda, we're aware of your time till 8:30 for another 4-5 minutes. Would you happen to have another 15, 20 minutes if possible?
Absolutely. No problem.
There's so many questions coming in.
No problem. I'd be delighted. Because I don't find this kind of young people to talk to. Okay.
Thank you. So, thank you so much. Yashwant, your question, please.
Thank you so much, sir. I'm literally pinching myself to making sure that this is actually real and I'm not dreaming. I am indeed speaking to Dr. Sam Pitroda. Wow. Anyway, so my question goes like this. Especially when you're trying to implement such rapid changes, and such disruptive technologies into a industry or a sector which is not aware of what this means, or you face a lot of hesitation and you face a lot of backlash, or let's say people not coordinating. So how did you manage that part when you were? So the reason I ask that is we may face similar situations in our careers going forward.
I think courage is very important in life. A lot of people don't have courage. Courage to stand up at the right time. Courage to back truth. Courage to trust people. Courage is not very common. Everybody wants to hide somewhere. Everybody wants somebody else to take the risk and they want to reap the rewards. Yeah. Management schools teach you more about how to extract value and not create value. Understand this very carefully. It is not about extracting value. It is about creating value. You need guts to stand up and say, hey, I will not tolerate this. This is not acceptable. I don't buy this. And you've got to have your feet grounded in fundamentals. Okay. That I will not do anything wrong. If I have to pay price, I will pay the price. Because in the long run, you're going to win. In the short run, you may lose. Everybody wants shortcut. You must recognize that all of you live to be 120 to 150 years. Take it from me. So don't plan your life based on 60 years and retire at 60. When I was growing up, average lifespan was 51. So growing up, you are said that, you know, maybe you study for 20, you get married, and then you enjoy your grandchildren, and then you die at 60. That was the idea growing up. Then you realize even at 80, you could be working 12 hours a day, enjoying life, having a good time. Especially knowing the fact that I had 2 quadruple bypasses, I had cancer. So technology will make sure that they won't let you die. So when you get into trouble another 30, 40 years, every body part would be replaced. You'll be on a production line, they'll fix you up like a car. So when you have 120-year lifespan, how do you plan your life? You need multiple careers. You need multidimensional approach. Today, everyone is taught in vertical silos. When I was growing up, I assumed that you can only be electrical engineer. Then you realize you can be electrical engineer, you can be barber, you can be gardener, you can be painter, you can be politician, you can be an entrepreneur. So you got to expand your horizon. And learning is a lifelong process. Learning never stops. Every day I spend 2-3 hours reading, and I'm fascinated with the kind of new things I'm learning. There is so much to learn, and there is so little I know. Whether it is oceanography, nanotechnology, genetics, biotech, COVID, or something else. To learn, you need to motivate yourself. To learn, you have to have time. If you don't spend time, you never learn. If you're not motivated, nobody can teach you anything. So many times my wife would say, why don't you watch? Because she's watching TV and I'm not doing anything. I'm just doing my thing. I just sit with her because so then she knows that it's, you know, he's here. So every once in a while, you know, she'll go out and come back and say, what happened? I have no idea what happened on TV because I'm looking, but I'm not watching. Because my mind is somewhere else. I've just read an article in Economist, Wall Street Journal, or some great, interesting, you know, piece of literature. So learning is very important. So it all depends on how you plan your life. See, I tell students that to me, discipline, analysis, creativity, ethics, respect for other human beings, all of these things are so very important. Analytics, let me give you an example of analytics. Every time you look at number graph chart, you immediately have to analyze. So when I was in the business in America in early days, all my accountants were scared of me. Why? Because I was taught in India mathematics in my mind and not on calculator. So I could multiply 34 by 7 just in my mind because that's what I was taught. So these American accountants would present a data and I would say, oh, it is 3.5% of that. And they would say, how did you get 3.5%? So they'll take their calculator, calculate, and they'll say, ah, 3.5%. So their fear was that don't play with numbers with Sam. That ability to analyze data is a very important part of your management learning. Things are going up, things are going down, things don't look right, it is up, down. You know, all this stuff is very critical. And sometimes we don't realize that ability to analyze just by looking at something is so very critical in life. That this trend is not right. Look at the graph. So these are some of the practical lessons you learn in your life.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Yashwant. Rakesh, you may ask your question now.
I will be now brief in answering. Go ahead.
I feel privileged to ask you this. And this is a question from my father, who is a great fan of you and Sri Rajiv Gandhi.
Thanks.
So out of the many beautiful years of your association with Sri Rajiv Gandhi, can you please narrate us one beautiful moment or anecdote that you cherish?
Oh, there are so many. I've written a lot about these things, but I'll give you one interesting example. You know, when Gorbachev was visiting India as a president of Soviet Union, I wanted to meet him. Okay. So I told Rajiv that, look, Rajiv, I got to meet him because I believe he's doing a lot of these things because of information technology. Because if you can see TV on east side of Berlin, you know exactly what is going on west side of Berlin, and Berlin Wall has no meaning. It had meaning when you couldn't see what's happening on the other side. So I want to poke him. He said, no problem. So he put in a request to his bureaucracy, Ministry of Foreign Affairs and External Affairs and Secretary and all that. And day before, after Gorbachev came to Delhi, he called me and he said, Sam, I'm sorry, you can't meet him because our bureaucracy and their bureaucracy do not agree that President of Soviet Union will meet only Prime Minister and President. Can't meet some crazy little, you know, long-haired, bearded, you know, guy called Sam Pitroda. It don't make sense. Though I was minister in his government, you know, minister level. So he said, you know, I'm very sorry. I said, let's think about an answer. So I told him, I said, why don't you just, he's coming to your house for dinner. So why don't you tell him after the dinner, you want to have coffee with somebody? He said, good idea. I said, then we bypass bureaucracy completely. So he agreed. So he said, okay, you get ready at 10 o'clock at night, come home, and we'll have coffee with you. So I told Jairam Ramesh. Jairam Ramesh used to be my chief of staff.
Okay.
For 7 years. So I said, Jairam, get ready, get some slide presentations, Kodak 35 millimeter slides. Told another friend of mine, Dr. Ashok Ganguly, who was chairman of Hindustan Liver. And we showed up at 10 o'clock at Rajiv's house. And Gorbachev finishes his dinner and Rajiv said, okay, I want you to meet some friends, Sam Petroda. So Gorbachev comes in and Rajiv and Gorbachev are in the conference room. There are 3-4 of us and we spend an hour and a half with him. Okay. So he was one of those who could bend rules a little bit. And I had so many interactions, you know, just hundreds and hundreds. I found him to be a very good human being. We clicked. He was young, energetic, good looking, you know, full of energy, new ideas, ready to support, you know, and we created a sort of bond full of trust. If anybody went to him and said, oh, Sam didn't do this right, he wouldn't be listened. Okay. Then once I wanted him to meet with a group of intellectuals like Rajni Kothari and others. And he wanted to do it, but his bureaucracy won't let him do it. So finally, he agreed and he said, okay, he'll spend half an hour. So I had about 15 intellectuals from all walks of life in 86. And normally I would sit next to him. I was not a very hierarchical guy. You know, when Prime Minister came, everybody would stand up. I wouldn't stand up. It didn't bother him. He was okay. Everybody else was bothered, you know, but he didn't care. Okay. And there was a garbage can next to him. So he would put his foot on garbage can. I would put my foot. He would shake it for a while. Then he'll turn it over to me. So I'll shake it for a while. And we had this little thing going on the side. Okay. And he spent 2.5 hours instead of half an hour with intellectuals. He enjoyed it. And he said, Sam, we should do more often these things. Then there was once a meeting of about 300 top people in India on celebrating 40th year of Indian independence. I was sitting right in the back at the end. And he's chairing the meeting. And he's constantly sending me little slips with notes. So security guy would take his note, deliver it to me. Everybody's looking at this. But we have this communication going on between two of us while the meeting is going on. So it was great. Unfortunately, I never took a photograph with him. You know, I didn't realize that. My wife did, but I never. It didn't occur to me. I normally don't take pictures with anybody. Okay, Gorbachev came. I don't take pictures with anybody. You know, but now I miss. I wish I had taken. I have his photograph there. You can see right there. You see?
Yes.
That's the picture of Rajiv the day he died. So he was a great, great human being. He really changed my life. So I'm very thankful to him.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for these memories.
Thank you, Rakesh, for asking a question. So Dr. Petroda, respecting your time, we'll just take one last question by Saurabh and followed by a small vote of thanks by Siddharth. So Saurabh, you may ask your question, please.
Sure. Good morning to you, sir. Thank you so much for addressing us. And you managed to concentrate so many important life lessons in such a short amount of time. You talked about trust, you talked about building institutions. So, and you obviously talked about leading India's last IT revolution. So my question to you is, what do you think is the next technological revolution in India? How do you see the current space in India with so many startups and new companies in the technology space? And where do you see technologies like cryptocurrencies and blockchain solving some of the problems that you talked about, like institutional trust and so on? So what are your thoughts on what's next for India's technology space?
I believe, again, I may not be qualified to answer your question, to be very frank, okay? Because I'm basically into IT. There is so much going on in biotech, nanotech, material, energy, health, which is going to transform everything. There is more revolution coming in the area of health than in IT. But IT has become pervasive. So I see hyper-connectivity will be at the core of future, all kinds of development. So hyperconnectivity will change the way we work. the way we interact, the way we socialize, the way we govern, the way we educate, the way we provide health services, the way we grow our food, process our food, store our food. Food chain will change because of hyperconnectivity. So I see hyperconnectivity as the core on which other inventions related to biotech, nanotech, material, energy will ride. Big data analytics will give us more intelligence. Machine learning will give us new tools. Blockchain is just a general ledger. So, I mean, I'm not too excited about, you know, it's a general ledger. I think it's blown out of proportion, but that's okay. You know? So I believe because of hyperconnectivity, everything we do today is basically obsolete, completely obsolete. The way we teach is obsolete. Why does it take $200,000 to get an MBA in America? You know, what you learn today is equally important. What did you pay for learning today? Nothing. So I think the old models don't work. Who said it should take 4 years to get a degree? Why does it take 4 years? And why guys sitting in Delhi decide what course you should take? Come on, give me a break. He has no idea of what you want to learn. You are the customer. You should decide. Some old guy in Delhi decides what you should learn. It's a funny thing. I would reject it. Say, who the hell are you? I want to learn how to make wine. I want to learn how to paint like Picasso. And I want to be an engineer. And I want to be a manager. Okay? So I want to learn what I want to learn. Don't tell me what I should learn. Don't put me in a vertical silo. So let me give you one last example to really tell you how the world is going to change. You know, when the self-driven car becomes a reality, which is another 5 years, maybe 10 years, okay? Let's see what happens. When self-driven car becomes a reality, I would not like to own a car because I'll be able to order a car whenever I want, wherever I want, whatever type of car I want to take me wherever I want to go. So why should I own a car? So I won't need driver's license. I won't need insurance. I won't need garage. And millions of square feet of office space, I mean the garage space in heart of town will be empty. Because you don't need to park a car. I won't need traffic light. Look at all the traffic lights all over in the world. You don't need traffic lights. You won't need signboards on the road. Because on the panel, it'll say, as you drive, it'll say whatever ad it is on the panel. Look at the amount of money we spend on signboards. You go to Bombay Airport, you see all this big hoarding for what? Okay, it's all bogus. So everything we do today is obsolete. Now let's take another step. Today we produce 50 million cars a year. 90% of the time car is parked. So if I was to produce car for tomorrow, I'll produce 5 million cars for the world and not 50 million. Because these cars are automatic and they drive all over. You know, they'll go to some repair center once in a while, and they'll just plug something in, it'll be repaired, and then it's ready to go. And car will have place to sleep. So if you're doing an evening journey, it's like a hotel. Okay. It'll be like an office, a desk, and everything would be there. And you know, while you go to work, you'll be working. Okay. If you make 5 million cars a year, it means you don't need that much steel. You don't need that much tires, rubber. You don't need that much material, okay. And you won't have that many jobs. So the idea of work is going to change. You will not have 9-to-5 job that you are looking for after your MBA. There won't be a such thing. Full-time job, company, loyalty, insurance, you know, pension, it's all gone, it's over. Okay. So job will have a different meaning. And you'll have multiple jobs, you'll have assignments. But you'll have more free time to explore your life. Everything is going to be cheaper. It is going to be demonetized. transport is going to demonetize, energy would be free. Like today, communication is free. This did not cost us anything. Okay. So tomorrow energy would be free. You'll have a little battery in the backyard and it will power your entire house all your life with some chemical reaction. Okay. Food would be so cheap because you'll be able to grow 20 times food on the same 1 acre land. So you will be really free to explore life. Today, most of us spend 9 to 5 for 40 years making living. So you can put food on the table, go take a little vacation, have maybe 1 car, 2 car, and your whole life is gone. What do? You're working to survive. That will change in the future. You will explore life differently. So I think future is absolutely fascinating. It depends on how we want to build it. And you guys are very important. You have to be the change agents. If you don't demand change, you will not get change. You need courage to demand change. Thank you.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Sorry, some of my answers are too long.
We're absolutely enjoying them, Dr. Pitroda, but just we're very aware of your time.
No problem. Don't worry, relax. I'm okay. You know, today is Saturday, so I have next appointment. I have to go get the COVID test again because I just came back from London. I went to London for 2 days. And I just came back yesterday. So my doctor says, hey, why don't you get another COVID test? And then tomorrow I'm going to take a booster.
Okay.
So, you know, I have some great doctor friends here, Indians, just unbelievable people. They are my close friends. And they watch me very carefully. You know, they come home every week to make sure I'm okay. And they're just great people. You know, great friends. So I'm lucky to have some wonderful friends. So they decide when I take test, they decide when I take injection, they get an appointment done and they call me and say, okay, you have an appointment tomorrow at 12:30, go get your injection. You know, that's the friendship. So I'm blessed. Thank you.
So this thank you note is inspired from a conversation with one of my friends and batchmates who said that this Zoom conversation with you, Dr. Pitroda, is only possible because of the foundation laid by you. And I'm sure the entire audience echoes the same. For many of us here, as we said earlier, you were a part of our school and college textbook, a construct of our imagination. But today, we are fortunate enough to have shared a few moments with you, Dr. Pitroda. You're a titan, global patriot, a living legend, and your humility goes beyond what we thought we imagined you as. Many of our grandparents and parents are fortunate to have witnessed the transformative change brought about by you. From the days of waiting hours to say hello on a lightning call to the ephemeral pings on our smart devices that have become fundamental to our being today. Fraternities like IIM Kozhikode are able to march on amidst today's pandemic ridden India only by reaping the benefits of the cornerstones laid by you. Once again, this Zoom call and our WhatsApp conversations are small testaments to it. Redesign the World calls for action with purpose, empathy, and inclusivity. We, the future business leaders, will cherish this interaction with you as we charge into the world to make our mark, a world better than one that we inherited. We thank you for your wisdom, inspiration, and time. I would like to extend my gratitude to Mr. Rakesh Patel and your office for being a pillar of support over the last few weeks. I would also like to thank our Honorable Program Chair, Professor Arghun Mateen, for presiding over this session and whose zeal, enthusiasm, and humor is a source of energy to all of us. This event also would not have been possible without the firm support of Mr. Suresh Kumar, Head of Corporate Relations, IIMK, and his team. Lastly, I would like to thank the IIMK fraternity, the chairperson's faculty, and my batchmates for making this session an unforgettable experience. Good morning, good night, and Godspeed. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, everybody. Enjoy. I'm sorry I wasn't dressed properly, but I hope that's okay.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pitroda. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Take care.
Thank you, sir.